all of it.
That's good. This should be on the run. I want to always go back to our outline. It's interesting because the more I study the book of Revelation, the more important the outline becomes to me all the time to keep me on track of where things are happening within the book of Revelation. And without that, you can get kind of lost in the book of Revelation, but it's been super helpful. And if I start getting confused about stuff as I'm studying, I just go, okay, I got to go back there. What was going on during this little short period? And then it brings you back to, okay, then this is what's going on right here. Even though it becomes very wild language at times and things like that, it kind of brings you back to knowing where you're at. So that's important. So we're always going to be referring back to that. Anyway, let's pray, and then we'll kind of review a little bit, and we'll jump into looking at the third and fourth trumpet judgments today. So that's what we're going to be looking at. So let's pray. Father, we just thank you for an opportunity to spend some time in your word. We ask for understanding, Lord. These things are sometimes a little hard to comprehend of all of what's going on, Lord, and totally understand these things. And yet, Lord, we do know that you want us to grasp what's going to happen on this earth in a future day, Lord, with a great, I know part of the reason for that is just so we understand how everything is going to come to pass. And you just want to show us your faithfulness. But Lord, we know too that you want us to be able to see from the things that are going to take place on the earth in the future. You want us to be able to see how those things relate to things going on in our own day, so that we might be on guard, that we might be wise, as it were, as serpents and gentle as doves, Lord. So I just pray, Lord, that you would really give us your wisdom today, help us understand these things, and put this all in a very good way of being able to understand it for us, Lord. I just thank you. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen. Well, it's been 2 weeks, so we probably forgot everything we studied. So let's start at Revelation chapter 1. We'll go back to the beginning of verse 8, or chapter 8. Remember, we looked at the first two trumpets and the trumpet judgments. And at this point, we are now in the second half of what's called the tribulation, or Daniel's 70th week. So we've entered into the last 42-month period of the last times and half of times, or the last 1260 days. Okay, so that's the time we've entered into as we're looking at these trumpet judgments. We know the seals that we saw, the seven seals, covered the first half of the tribulation and the events that took place there. So as we're going on here, we're looking at those things that are taking place in what Jesus, from our outline of Matthew 24, calls the Great Tribulation. Okay, so it's really the last 3.5 years that are the Great Tribulation. The whole period is tribulation, but that's the Great Tribulation. And so that's why I want to go back in a second to Matthew 24, because we want to know from that outline, what are the major things that are going on in that time? Okay, and then we can get a better understanding of the things we're seeing in these trumpet judgments, how they relate to that outline, and it gives us a clearer picture of what's being said there. Because sometimes it's graphic language, sometimes it's figurative language, sometimes it's literal language. And so if we keep in mind what our outline tells us, then we can pick up on both the literal aspects of it, and I believe also some of the figurative aspects of what's being said. So that's an important thing to remember. But as we saw the first two trumpets being blown 2 weeks ago, you might remember some of the things that we saw going on there. What this is the response to the prayers of the saints, and judgment is now coming to the earth. Okay, the judgment that's been promised, that wrath is to be poured out on the earth, begins to take place. And we saw in the first trumpet, as the first angel sounded, remember, there was hail and fire followed and mingled with blood, and they were thrown to the earth, and it said a third of the trees were burned up, and all the green grass was burned up. And then we saw, and the second angel sounded, and something like a great mountain burning with fire was thrown into the sea, and a third of the sea became blood, and a third of the living creatures in the sea died, and a third of the ships were destroyed. Now, if you remember right, we said these probably are very literal things happening on the earth, either worldwide or specifically in Israel. Okay, and much of this takes place in the land of Israel and the Middle East, I believe, but some of it's worldwide also. I mean, there's lots of it that we see as a worldwide devastation. But so literal things, but we also said there seemed to be also a spiritual meaning behind all of these things too. And it became pretty evident for sure in the second trumpet, didn't it? Because he said something like a great mountain being thrown down into the sea. Okay, so with that in mind, let's go back to Matthew 24, get our outline and see what's in the outline for that last half of the tribulation, and then we'll come back to that, discuss that for a minute, and move on. So in Matthew 24, remember we had said verses 4 through 14 covered the whole seven-year period. Picking up in verses 15 through 28, we get a deeper description of those events that take place from the time of the abomination of desolation until the second coming of Jesus, which covers the last 3.5 years, 1260 days, times, times, and half a time. I'm going to start using those terms a little more because we'll start hearing that more as we go on now. So 1260 days, times, times, half a times, which is 3.5 years, or those are all the same thing, okay? 1260 days, 42 months, times, times, and half a times, okay? So you'll hear those phrases, and that's the last period that we're in. So verse 9, remember, that's where the transition takes place. We know that at the middle of the tribulation, according to verse 15, the abomination of desolation takes place. We know from other passages, 2 Thessalonians, Daniel, other places, it's at that point that Satan declares himself, or the Antichrist declares himself under the power of Satan, to be God in the temple of God. He does away with the daily sacrifice and the offering. He changes times and seasons. He sets up a whole new program. The whole new program is a religious program that ultimately brings worship to who? Him. Okay, so ultimately, it's worship of the Antichrist, and really behind that, Satan worship. So really, in that last 3.5 years of the tribulation, the world is going to become Satan worshipers. All right, that's what he's going to try and enforce upon the whole world, that they all worship him. We know that that's one of the things, he has authority over every tribe, nation, and tongue towards the end, and tries to demand worship of all of them. Those that won't worship him, he'll kill. So we see there, then it says in verse 9, they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. Now he's talking specifically there to Jewish people, isn't he? Okay. Then he goes on. So that's one of the things. There's going to be tribulation. There's going to be death. All right. So tribulation, death, and destruction. The nations are going to be very anti-Semitic in that day. Okay. And that's in the second half of the tribulation. In the first half, there will be some different things going on. There will be anti-Semitism, but then there's going to be an acceptance of a Jewish Christendom. Okay, and we'll discuss that a little bit later today. I think it's something we need to be very, very aware of today. Jewish Christendom, or we might call it replacement theology. Okay, Marlene gave me some interesting, YouTube videos of a dialogue and discussion that was going on between a replacement theologian and a Jewish Christian, and pretty good, and some stuff people might want to watch to help you understand a little bit about some of the things we'll talk about today and some of the things that are going on as it relates to this idea of replacement theology. Anyway, so he goes on in verse 10, he says, and then many will be offended, will betray one another, and will hate one another. So obviously brother is going to turn against brother, sister against sister, father against father. So when these things happen and this tribulation begins, people are going to be trying to save their own necks as this persecution starts. And so they become traitors and such. He says, then many false prophets will rise and deceive many. So we have not only death, destruction, natural things that are going on where there's the loss of life and obviously devastation of the earth, but there's a major thing, and this is a major issue in the last part of the tribulation, is false prophets and ultimate deception. Really, like the world's never seen, deceiving, that's going to cause, if it's possible, even the elect to be deceived. And the elect, there would be believers in the tribulation period. It says, if possible, it would cause even the elect to be deceived. It says, so many false prophets will rise up and deceive many, and because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. Obviously, if there's any love in him, it becomes a very cold scenario. It says, but he who endures to the end shall be saved. Now, the idea of enduring to the end and being saved is not saved in the sense of salvation or redemption. It's the idea of being saved through and out of the tribulation. And it says, in this gospel, the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all nations, and then the end will come. So quite a few things going on. Tribulation, death, destruction, major deception, but also the gospel being preached to the kingdom, the idea of the kingdom of God. And that gospel, the kingdom being preached, and people still getting saved even in that day. But major deception and delusion is one of the big features that goes on along with death and destruction. Again, as we pick up in verse 15 with more details, I'm not going to read all of it. But again, he says there's the abomination of desolation that's spoken of by Daniel the prophet. We know that that's the bringing of the image of the beast into the temple of God, and the false prophet there demanding, we'll read about that today, demanding that people worship that image of the beast. That's when Antichrist sets himself up to be God in the temple of God. And so the people of Jerusalem and Judea, the people in Israel, they need to flee at that point, and they flee to a place where God, according to the book of Revelation, gives them a place to retreat to and hide, where they'll be preserved to some extent, as we find out from Revelation 12. And he says of those, he said, verse 21, he says, for there will be great tribulation such as not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. So tribulation could include, again, the death and devastation, the natural disasters that are taking place on the earth. Really, we can't call them natural, but they're happening in the natural realm. obviously, it's all by judgment, so it's all by God's hand. And it says, unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. So there's the reality that if the days weren't shortened, everybody would die on the earth. But for the elect's sake, he says, those days are shortened. And then he goes on, he says, then if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there, do not believe it. So we get back to this major deceptions going on, these major delusions that are taking place. We know from 2 Thessalonians that God says that he will send upon them a strong delusion, that they believe the lie instead of the truth of God. And so ultimately the lie is going to be that they're going to believe that God all along really is Lucifer, is really what's going to happen in the very end. He says, for false Christs and false prophets will rise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. See, I've told you beforehand, therefore, if they say to you, look, he is in the desert, do not go out, or look, he is in the inner rooms, do not believe it. So the Jews are going to be being constantly seduced by this demonic delusion and deception to come out to see the Christ in these places. And it's not the Christ that's of the Bible, obviously. He says, don't believe it. Don't come out. He says, for as lightning comes from the east and flashes the west, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. So obviously there's going to be this very, very strong pull by the false prophets and the false Christ and all this delusion to try and get people, the Jewish people, to come out and follow after this Antichrist, okay? And so great deception. And probably part of that deception is to get them to come out so they can kill them, okay? Come out of their hiding. And so that's probably what much of it's about, not just to try and deceive them, but that they'd come out and see that, and then they'd be killed in that day. So there's our outline again. All right, so our outline tells us again about things. It's going to be death and destruction. Okay, boom, flesh being destroyed. So we know that's a very physical thing that's going to be happening, but it also tells us there's going to be major spiritual upheaval, because there's going to be false prophets and false Christs bringing great delusion, lying signs and wonders, deceiving, if possible, even the elect. Okay, and so those are important features as we continue on in these trumpet judgments to understand what's going on. Because like I said, the language I believe is literal, but I believe it also has a spiritual overtone to it every time. And let's go back to the second trumpet and talk about that for a second. The second trumpet, again, we see this thing like a great mountain burning with fire. It's thrown into the sea. A third of the sea became blood. And a third of living creatures in the sea died, and a third of the ships were destroyed. Now, I'm not doubting maybe something falls from heaven, and there's devastation in the earth and the sea from this, okay? That the sea turns, part of the sea turns to blood and so on. I believe those are literally going to happen. But we also remember, if we remember right, we went to Jeremiah 31 or 51, and what did it tell us there? It told us about this great mountain that's thrown down into the sea, okay? And what was that great mountain? It was Babylon, okay, or that house of idolatry. And so then we looked and we realized later on, when we get to chapter 17 and 18 in Revelation, there it teaches us there about the casting down of both ecclesiastical Babylon and commercial Babylon, okay? And when we get there, we'll get into that in much more detail. But ecclesiastical Babylon is mystery Babylon, the mystery of iniquity that's already at work in the earth today, okay? Remember, Paul says mystery of iniquity is already at work. John says the spirit of Antichrist is already at work amongst us. So that's already going on today. It's part of that mystery Babylon, that false ecclesia. What's the ecclesia? Everybody know what ecclesia is? It's the church. Okay, so there's that false church. Now, I'll say this, there's going to be a false church that goes right on into the tribulation. Okay, and that's mystery Babylon. That's the woman that rides the beast. And so it's a form of Judeo-Christianity. And we'll get into that and talk about that a little bit further when we look at some of these judgments. But it's got a form of godliness, but denies the power thereof. The people that are involved in it are ever learning, but never able to come to the knowledge of the truth because they deny the Lord who bought them. Okay, and ultimately, they deny that divinity or that person of Jesus Christ is who they really deny. But we'll see that that's what's going to come about. So we know there from that second trumpet, what it was dealing with was ecclesiastical Babylon being thrown down. So at the middle of the tribulation, right at that time when Satan falls from heaven and there's the declaring of the Antichrist be God in the temple of God, right around that time, Satan is done with the ecclesiastical movement, mystery Babylon. He doesn't need her anymore, okay? And we know from Revelation 17 that the 10 kings that are under the Antichrist's authority that he's given, they give all their authority to him ultimately, but he's given authority on the earth, they destroy her, okay? They're done away with her. Then after that, towards the end of the tribulation, we see another aspect of Babylon, commercial Babylon, political Babylon destroyed, okay? And it's destroyed by the hand of God. One's destroyed by the 10 kings. The other one is destroyed by the hand of God. And so we'll see that later, not today. We'll see that as we get into our study. So everybody following so far what we're looking at here? Okay, so again, as we get to these trumpet judgments, we need to relate them to our outline. Remember that there's probably a literal event happening in the physical realm, but behind it, there are also spiritual truths that we need to glean. And I think for us, it's the spiritual truths that are really, really important for us to pick up on because it helps us understand the tide that's carrying people away right now today. Okay? Helps us understand that spiritual delusion and deception that's already underway, the mystery of iniquity that's already at work in our midst. And I'll tell you, the mystery of iniquity works where? In the church. That's what Paul was talking about. When John said there's already many antichrists that have gone out and the spirit of antichrist is already at work, he's talking about that's working inside the church. John was dealing with the Gnostic delusions and stuff during that time and various different things. So there's that deception that's already gone out into the earth. So let's go ahead and pick up with our third angel now. Okay, verse 10. It says, then the third angel sounded, and a great star fell from heaven, burning like a torch, and it fell on the third of the rivers and on the springs of the water. The name of the star is Wormwood. A third of the waters became wormwood, and many men died from the bitter water. Many men died from the water because it was made bitter. I'm going to go ahead and read on into the fourth angel too here, okay? And I'm going to read on into the fifth angel also, all right? And then we're going to come back and look at it. It says, so remember we've got this wormwood falling from heaven. It's a star coming down, falling from heaven. It says, and the fourth angel sounded, a third of the sun was struck, a third of the moon, and a third of the stars, so the third of them were darkened, a third of the day did not shine, and likewise the night. And I looked and heard an angel flying through the midst of heaven saying with a loud voice, woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth because of the remaining blasts of the trumpet. main blast of the trumpet of the three angels who are about to sound. Then the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star fallen from heaven to earth. To him was given the key to the bottomless pit, and he opened the bottomless pit, and smoke rose out of the pit like the smoke of a great furnace. So the sun and the air were darkened because of the smoke of the pit. Then out of the smoke, locusts came upon the earth, and to them was given power, as the scorpions of the earth have power. They were commanded not to harm the grass of this earth or any green thing or any tree, but only those men who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. And they were not given authority to kill them, but to torment them for 5 months. Their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it strikes a man. In those days, men will seek death and will not find it. They will desire to die, and death will flee from them. The shape of the locust was like the horses prepared for battle. On their heads were crowns of something like gold, and their faces were like the faces of men. They had hair like women's hair, and their teeth were like lion's teeth. And they had breastplates like breastplates of iron. And the sound of their wings was like the sound of chariots with many horses running into battle. They had tails like scorpions, and there were stings in their tails. Their power was to hurt men 5 months, and they had a king over them, the angel of the bottomless pit. His name in Hebrew is Abaddon, but in Greek has the name of Apollyon, the destroyer. Wow. Interesting stuff, huh? Okay, so let's back up. Yeah, a little frightening, just pretty wild scene, huh? So again, physical, natural things happening on the earth, but obviously as we read this, there's a spiritual side to this that's very demonic and very, very dark. And so as we open it up, let's see what we start coming up with here. So going back to verse 10, the third angel sounded, and a great star fell from heaven, burning like a torch, and it fell on a third of the springs and on the springs of water. The name of the star is Wormwood. Now, the name Wormwood means bitterness, okay? And so it makes the waters bitter. And we say, so great stars falling from heaven. So something fell out of the heavens. There's probably a star that's going to fall out of the heavens, okay? And it's probably going to make some of the waters bitter, all right? It's going to fall in the sea, and a third of the sea, and a third of the fresh waters, and all these things are going to turn to bitterness. So the name of the star is Wormwood. A third of the waters became Wormwood, and many men died from the water because it was made bitter. Okay, so I think it's a physical thing that happens. All right, and men are going to die from that. Like it says, if these days weren't shortened, all flesh should perish. There wouldn't be anybody left, but there's going to be those left. So that's happening, but here again, there's a spiritual side behind this. There's something else going on, okay? And this wormwood, this one that makes bitter, this one that we're going to see is one who, I believe, opens the key to the bottomless pit too, because it's the same person that's being talked about and is also the king of the locusts, is the one that we're dealing with, okay? Now, who's the king and the angel of the bottomless pit? And who's the king of the locusts? And who's the star that's fallen from heaven? Let's go to Isaiah 14. And I think we'll start to see a little more insight into what's going on here. Like I said, no doubt, a physical thing that happens with a spiritual understanding behind it that we have to glean. In Isaiah 14... just an interesting chapter, okay, dealing with Babylon and the king of Babylon, but dealing with Babylon's destruction in the end times, okay? I believe it's dealing with Babylon and relating things as Babylon related to Israel in those days, but when we really look at the text and dig into it, what we're finding out is it's talking about the destruction of Babylon, and it's also talking about Satan, who is the morning star, falling. Okay, and ultimately his judgment. So I'm not going to read the whole chapter. You might look at it on your own and spend some time studying it. I think it's very intriguing and interesting. It relates to a lot of what we're studying, and we'll probably come back and look at it when we look at chapter 17 and 18 of Revelation. But for now, I just want to deal with the primary thing that we're looking at here. So go to verse 12. And it says, "How you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning." Or the morning star, okay? How are you fallen? How are you cut down to the ground, you who weaken the nations, okay? Now, notice there's a future aspect to this. We know that Satan rebelled against God, right? And he drew a third of the stars of heaven with him when he did that. Now, what are the stars of heaven that he's talking about? The angelic hosts. So he took a third of them with him in his rebellion. But right now, Satan still has access, according to Revelation chapter 12, another place, he still has access to what? The throne of God, and so do his fallen angels. Okay? So they still have access because right now he's what? He's the accuser of the brethren, isn't he? Okay? And he's the one, it says here, who weakened the nations. Okay, so he's the one who weakens the nations. He's the one who's at work presently. We know from Ephesians chapter 2, he is the what? Prince in the power of the air. He's the God of this age. Okay? The kingdoms of this earth lie under the sway of the wicked one. So he's weakened the nations right now. He doesn't have unlimited power. His power is limited right now, but he still does this work of limiting the nations. And notice it says prior to that, he says, how you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning, how you are cut down to the ground. Now that talks about a future aspect. He's rebelled, but there's a future aspect of his judgment. It goes on to say, for you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven. So this is his rebellion. I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will also sit on the mount of the congregation on the farthest sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. Yet you shall be brought down to Sheol, the lowest depths of the pit. Okay? So it talks about there's going to be this judgment for him. And it goes on and talks about those issues that are going on there. So we know that there's a time in which this star is going to fall. He's going to be cast down and cut down to the ground and ultimately go into judgment. And that final judgment for him will be what? The lake of fire. All right? Now, so let's go over to Revelation chapter 12. Now, remember this again. This is important. When we finish the seven trumpets, we're going to be at the end of the tribulation period. Okay, that's covered the whole 7 years, and it comes right up to the second coming of Christ. In Revelation 11, 18, we see the second coming of Christ, the judgments that take place, and really almost go all the way up into the millennium. We do. And so that's what's there. And then, starting in verse 19 of chapter 11, John begins to prophesy again. At the end of chapter 10, John eats a little book, it's a little scroll, and he's told to prophesy again. Chapters 12 on through the end of the book are his prophesying again. And he's told to prophesy about peoples and tongues and nations and so on. So that's what he's doing from chapter 12 on. He's starting to tell us about the peoples, the nations, the tongues, the different groups of people that are involved in the different things that are going on. All right. So in chapter 12, one of the people that he's prophesying about, or one of the, I guess we can call it a personages that he's prophesying about, is Wormwood, okay? Satan, the one who's fallen from heaven. And here, let's go ahead and take a look at chapter 12. We've looked at this a few times, but let's go back. It says, he saw a great sign in heaven. There's a woman clothed with the sun, the moon under her feet, and on her head a garland of 12 stars. Remember that, too, for our study today, because we're going to see something else here that I think is interesting. Who did that describe, by the way? Israel, remember? Okay. Then being with child, she cried out in labor and pain to give birth. And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great fire red dragon having 7 heads, 10 horns, and 7 diadems on his head. Same things that the Antichrist has, because he's the one who empowers. He's the embodiment of the Antichrist. The Antichrist is the embodiment of him, I guess I should say. Now his tail drew a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. Okay, so that's talking about his rebellion. And so we know the angels are still have access to heaven, but they're also thrown down to this earth. Who do you think is giving us trouble down here? It's not Satan himself. He probably doesn't deal with you and I. He's probably dealing with Donald and Vladimir and people that are a little more important than us, okay? But these fallen angels are down here causing us problems. We wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against powers and principalities and what is it, spiritual forces in heavenly places and spiritual forces of wickedness in heavenly places. We're dealing with an angelic host that's been drawn down a third of the stars of heaven. I don't know how many that is, but it's plenty to make a mess. Okay? It's plenty to make the nations struggle and cause the nations to have problems. And so we know that that's what happened. So let's talk about his rebellion. It says, and the dragon stood before the woman who was ready to give birth to devour her child as soon as she was born. So notice again in this chapter, we skip huge periods of time. Okay, goes from his rebellion up into the time where he's standing before Israel as the woman is giving birth to the child. The child is the one who's to rule the nations with a rod of iron. Who's that? It's Jesus. So we move right up to the time of his birth where the dragon is standing there ready to devour. Now, how did Satan, was it Satan himself appearing there trying to kill the child? No, that's what we always need to remember. Satan doesn't ever appear. He's always working through a person as you're an entity, a person. So who was he working through there when he tried to kill the male child? Herod. Through Herod. Remember, they killed all the male children. What was it, 2 years?
2 years and younger.
2 years and younger. Thank you. Okay, 2 years and younger, he killed all the male children trying to do what? Trying to destroy Jesus. Trying to get that Christ child. Didn't work, did it? Okay, because of God's provision. Says she bore a male child, describes who that is. Then the woman fled into the wilderness where she had a place prepared for her by God that they should feed her 1,260 days, 42 months, times, half times, okay? And so then it goes on and it says, and war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon. Okay, so now we see again, we're skipping big periods of time, right? So we go from the devouring of the male child to the male child being removed from that place. Okay, he's caught up to God in his throne in verse 5. So that's his ascension. So we go from his birth all the way to his ascension. And then we skip an entire age. Between 5 and 6, we skip an entire age. What's that age? We're living in it. Okay, that's us. We're the church age. That's what's going on. So between 5 and 6, the church age is not even discussed. We go right from God or Jesus being caught up to the throne, being ascended back to the Father's throne, to the woman fleeing to the wilderness from this persecution that we see. So what's happened is at this point, we move right up to the middle of the tribulation, whereas the Antichrist declares himself to be God in the temple of God, and the woman has to flee to that place in the wilderness for the last 3.5 years of the tribulation. Okay, so jump right to that. It says, then war breaks out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon and his angels fought, but they did not prevail, nor was there a place found for them in heaven any longer. That's good news. Okay, they were cast out of heaven. So the great dragon was cast out, the serpent of old, called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. And so on, and then it goes on and tells some more of the story. And then we move down, and it says in verse 13, now when the dragon saw that he had been cast to the earth, what's he do? Well, he persecutes the woman who gave birth to the male child. So he comes after Israel, big time. Okay, now let's see how he comes after. She's given a place to hide out in the wilderness where she's nourished for a time, times, and half times from the presence of the serpent. Okay, so God's protecting her as the serpent's coming on with her. Now, notice what the serpent does here. It says, so the serpent, this being wormwood, spews water out of his mouth like a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away by the flood. But the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. And the dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of the offspring of her offspring who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. And remember, we talked about that probably being the 144,000. It goes after them, that offspring of Israel, the other offspring, okay, the first fruits. Now notice, what does Satan do? He spews out of his mouth a flood to try and destroy the woman. We go, really? So like water comes from his mouth, like a river comes out of his mouth and is trying to drown Israel? As they're spread out in the wilderness of nations? No, we're talking about something spiritual going on. What way we think of water being spewed out like a flood? What is water? In the Bible, water, and it describes something, doesn't it? Okay? We have living water that comes from God, don't we? Okay, and that living water is what nourishes us, isn't it? And nurtures us, and we live on that, okay, as Christians. Now, what would be maybe this water that's coming from Satan's mouth? Because living water can also relate to what?
Persecution.
Okay, so the persecution is coming with great delusion. Okay, remember this time is filled with false prophets and false Christ trying to delude the nation of Israel and trying to deceive them. Remember he said, if they say to you, he's in the desert, don't come out of hiding. If they say to you, he's in the upper room, don't come out of hiding. You're going to know when he comes, because when he comes, lightning is going to flash from the east to the west across the skies, and the sign of the Son of Man is going to appear in the clouds of glory, and then he's going to descend to this earth. So don't be deluded by what they're saying. So this flood, it's a flood of delusion. It's a flood of deception that comes from Satan's mouth. It's wormwood poisoning a third of the waters. It's bitterness, okay? When we think of demonic doctrines, what are they? They're not living water, they're bitter water. They're not the washing that the water of the Word can bring into our lives, but that those things delude our minds and cause great deception, okay? Even to the point where I believe men want to kill themselves, as we see in this chapter, but can't. We'll talk about that in a minute. Yeah, Annie?
It just popped in my mind that verse in Isaiah that says, when the enemy comes in like a flood,
yep,
the Spirit of God will raise up a standard
against him, yeah. And, you know, and amen, that has a millennial, I mean, that has a tribulational aspect to it too, you know. So, I mean, the Lord is still at work even when this is going on, because he's working with the nation of Israel, he's working with lost people still during that time. So I believe then that wormwood here and the star falling from heaven is the very thing we saw there in Isaiah. It's the thing we see in Revelation 12. It's Satan when he finally is cast down after this war goes on in heaven with Michael and archangels against them. Okay, and they're cast down to this earth, and so there begins to be then this destruction. Now, again, don't get me wrong. I think a physical thing happens as a sign of that, but there's the spiritual thing going on behind it. And so now we have the waters becoming bitter, not living water anymore. They're that which brings death. Okay, and that's what demonic doctrine, any kind of false doctrine, what does it ultimately bring into people's lives? It brings death. Okay, it cannot bring life because it's not from the life giver. Now, so let's move on here a little bit. Everybody's following so far where we're at, what's going on? Okay, so again, this is why our outline is so important, because this week studying, I got confused. I did. I just kind of lost where I was at everywhere. And I'm like, okay, I got to go back to the outline and I got to put this back together, because I was kind of confused at where I was going with stuff. Anyway, So the third angel sounded, so this great star falls from heaven. Then the fourth angel, verse 12, sounded, and a third of the sun was struck, a third of the moon, and a third of the stars. So that a third of them were darkened, a third of the day did not shine, and likewise the night. All right? Okay, so once again, because of what takes place with wormwood coming down and making the waters bitter, the next angel sounds, and then we have this next little judgment that takes place, and I believe it relates again to what wormwood has brought to the earth, what Satan is doing as he begins to persecute. Now, again, I believe there's a physical thing. I think what's going to happen is the third of the night sky, there's not going to be stars shining. People will be looking up going, there should be stars in the sky, and then halfway or third, whatever, third of the way into the night, the stars are going to shine again. That'll be a weird phenomenon, okay? During the day, the sun's going to be darkened for a third of the day, and then the sun will start shining. Things are going to be all out of balance. There's going to be chaos in the cosmos, okay? As there's chaos in the cosmos, there's also chaos in the spiritual realm, because there's this spiritual wickedness that's on the earth. And notice who it affects: the sun, the moon, and the stars. Did we just read about the sun and the moon and the stars? Who are they? Israel. Again, I believe it relates to this very thing. When Satan first comes down on this, he's going to persecute the whole world. But when he first comes down, who's he going after first? He's after Israel. He wants to wipe them off the face of the earth, and that's his primary objective in the end of the tribulation period. I mean, in the last 3.5 years, one of his primary objectives is to be rid of Israel. Okay? Now, he's gotten rid of, at this point already, the Judeo-Christian ecclesia. Now he's got one great enemy left that stands in the way of everything, and that's these Israelites who have suddenly had their eyes open, and they're turning because the fullness of Gentiles has come in with the rapture. Now their eyes are beginning to be open, and you got these Jews that are starting to believe he's not God. This Antichrist is not the Messiah. Our Messiah is the one whom we pierced. It's Jesus. It's the one of the Old Testament. They're going to start to understand the angel host of the Old Testament that they see throughout, those pre-incarnate things of Christ that we see throughout the Old Testament. They're going to start to see that angel priest is Jesus, okay, the Jesus of the New Testament too. Their eyes are going to be open, and so he wants to destroy them, because once their eyes get open like that, what can the Jews do? There's one thing that they can do if they remain as a people on the earth, and the one thing they have to do before Jesus can set foot on the Mount of Olives. There's one thing that has to take place through Israel before Jesus can set foot on the Mount of Olives. You guys remember what that is, right? Remember at the end of Matthew 23, what did he say? You will not see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. In Zechariah, we find out that those people begin to weep. The Jews begin to weep and mourn, and they look upon him whom they've pierced, and they cry out for his salvation. They call upon his name, and what does he do? He comes and sets foot on the Mount of Olives. He comes in his second coming. So see, Satan has to try and destroy them. So his primary objective, yeah, he's destroying flesh because he just does that. But his primary objective is to destroy them. And so he's sending out this flood of strong delusion to try and lead them away and lead them astray so he can get them out so he can then physically destroy them. Okay? Using all kinds of language of God and all kinds of religious pomp and circumstance and ceremony and all these things to try and get the people to come out and try and follow after this delusion that he has for them. But there's going to be that remnant group that are going to be protected. So that's what we see going on. So I believe that's what it's talking about when it talks about the sun, moon, and the stars and this persecution coming to them. There's a darkening. A third of them are darkened by the delusion. Now we know something. Before it's all over, two-thirds of the nation of Israel is caught up and destroyed. So right here, we see a third of them being deluded by it. A third of them are darkened. So they've been let out. Apparently, they've come out, and they've come looking for him in the desert, and they've come, you know, looking for him, and they've turned against one another. Okay? Brother against brother, it says. They're going to betray one another. And so it's this darkness that comes from this delusion that comes on the earth. And he says, and I looked, and I heard, verse 13, an angel flying through the midst of heaven saying, with a loud voice, woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth because of the remaining blasts of the trumpet of the three angels who are about to sound. Then the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star falling from heaven. It's the same star. Okay, he hasn't moved on to something different. He's saying, I saw a star falling from heaven. To him was given the key to the bottomless pit. What do you suppose is in the bottomless pit? Well, this locust plague is in the bottomless pit. Okay, and he opens up the bottomless pit. What do keys speak of in the scriptures? There's the key of David. Peter was given the keys to what? The kingdom. Keys open things up, and keys oftentimes open up either that which is of God. Okay, we have the key to open people's hearts up to the kingdom, don't we? Okay, by preaching the gospel to them. Okay, but this key is given to this angel, and he's opening the bottomless pit. Well, the bottomless pit doesn't sound like a good place, does it? Because out of it comes a locust plague. Okay, it's from the depths of Sheol, from the grave. All those things that are evil and deluded is what comes out of the bottomless pit. So he opens that up. He says he opens the bottomless pit, and smoke arose out of the pit like the smoke of a great furnace. So the sun and the air were darkened because of the smoke of the pit. Then out of the smoke, locusts came upon the earth, and to them was given power as scorpions of the earth have power. These don't sound like regular locusts, do they? Okay. It starts getting really weird. Anybody ever seen it? Locusts can be huge. Like in Israel, in the Middle East, the locusts are like big fellers like this. They're not like our grasshoppers. They're great big guys. And they come and they can darken the whole sun out, and they come like a cloud and they eat everything. People talk about like they eat the broom handles right out of the brooms. And I mean, they eat everything that can be eaten. Now, it's interesting because these locusts don't eat normally what locusts would eat. And they don't. These people, these ones start tormenting men. They're given the over to torment men. He says, so they were commanded not to harm the grass of the earth or any green thing or any tree. So I take that as literal there. They weren't supposed to harm those, which is normally what they would do if they were normal locusts. But already we're seeing they're not really normal locusts. But only those who had, they were commanded not to harm the grass of the earth or any green thing or any tree, but only those men who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. And they were not given authority to kill them, but to torment them for 5 months. Their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it strikes a man. Okay, so we're going, this is really weird. You know, something's going on. Now, is there some kind of weird locust that comes up and has this new ability that, you know, is it a genetically engineered locust? I don't know. What I think there's, again, a literal physical aspect to this going on. But let's go on and look at this a little bit more. He says, so they were able to torment men for 5 months. It says, in those days, men will seek death and will not find it. They will desire to die, and death will flee from them. So serious torment that's wanting them to seek death. Now he describes the locust. Says the shape of the locust was like a horse. Horses prepared for battle. Okay. Now locusts do look like they got armor on them. Okay. So they might look kind of like a horse prepared for battle. Says on their heads were crowns of something like gold. Now that gets a little weird. Gold in the scriptures speaks of deity, doesn't it? And a crown of gold. That's interesting. Okay. It says, and their faces were like the faces of men. Now, some people say those little locusts, when you get down and look at them closely, their little faces look like men, and maybe they do. I don't know. Okay? They're not little. And they had hair like a woman's hair. Now, they got antennas, but I don't know of any of them having hair. So that gets really weird. And the idea is apparently long, flowing locks. Okay? You're right. They do have hair on their legs, yeah. But this is kind of like, looks like a woman's hair on their head. So that's weird. So they must be hippie locusts. Says, and they had breastplates like breastplates of iron, and the sound of their wings was like the sound of chariots with many horses running into battle. And they have lions, teeth like lions. Now, some say that these locusts have teeth that are sharp little teeth that look like lions. And if they can eat a broom handle, I suppose they do have very sharp teeth. So maybe there's a locust plague. We know from Joel there's a locust plague in the last days. So I'm not saying that this isn't a real locust plague. But they had tails like scorpions, and there were stings in their tails. Their power was to hurt men 5 months. Now, I don't know any locusts that have a scorpion's tail and can sting like a scorpion and have the sting of a scorpion. So now we're talking about something that's different. And now this is where it gets really weird. And they had a king. Locusts have a king. Locusts move in swarms. Okay? They don't have a leader. They just move in swarms as one pack together. But these ones have a king over them, the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in Hebrew is Abaddon, but in Greek has the name Apollyon, which means destruction or the destroyer. Who's the destroyer? Satan himself. These locusts have Satan as their king. Who are these locusts? He drew a what? Third of the stars of heaven with him, and they were all cast down to the earth. So I really believe, yes, there's probably a literal locust plague, but it's also describing this issue of Satan and his fallen angels having unlimited power at this time. They have limited power now, but they have unlimited power to bring deception upon the earth at that time. And it's like the smoke that covers over anything that gives light. So it blots out the sun and anything that could give light. So the light, if there's any light of God, it's trying to be blotted completely out of this point. And that's what he's trying to do, is bring everybody in the whole world. This is every tongue, nation, and tribe come under his authority. And he demands, and we know that the false prophet demands they give him worship. Okay? And so it's at the same time that we see him empowering. Let's go to verses 13 or chapters 13, and we see him also empowering the Antichrist and the false prophet at the same time. So I believe this locust plague, the spiritual meaning behind it, is a demonic delusion that's running rampant upon the earth, where the Antichrist and the false prophet are starting to operate in their full power. We know the Antichrist, he has the same characteristics of Satan himself, doesn't he? seven heads and 10 horns, and on his seven heads, 10 diadems, and so on. And we see him having the very same characteristics, and we see him being given authority. Says he was granted to him, verse 7, to make war with the saints and overcome them. Authority was given to them, given to him over every tongue, nation, tribe. So he's coming after the saints, okay, with this strong delusion. And all who dwell on the earth, it says, will worship him, whose names have not been written in the book of life. So it's at that time where this worship takes place. Now we go down to verse 11, and there's the other beast. This is the false prophet. He is still the one who is, he's the one who leads the major delusion, isn't he? So Satan at this point has empowered him to be bringing all these false doctrines, all this delusion, and backing it up, as we see later on here, with what? He's able to call fire down from heaven and make all kinds of things happen. It says, granted him, it was granted, verse 15, power him to give, it was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many who would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. He causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive the mark on their right hand on their foreheads, that no one may buy, sell, or accept one who has the mark of the name of the beast or the number of the beast. And before that, it says that he's able to call fire down from heaven. So the false prophet is part of this demonic delusion and promoting it throughout the earth with other false prophets. And behind all that is the demonic hosts working that through these men. And that's, again, how that spiritual realm works. Even today, what's working behind the scenes? God is either working in us or someone else is working in us. Okay? The enemy and his hosts. And so we see this thing unleashed on the earth during that day, and that's what's going on there with this very strong delusion that's taking place. So, knowing that, that's going on, what are some of these delusions maybe that are going to come upon the earth? Okay? Obviously, the whole world is going to end up worshiping who? Satan. How does he do that, though? How does he get people to worship him ultimately? By first getting them to do something else. And it's the same thing that he did with Eve in the garden. What did he try and get Eve to do? He led her into self-worship. Okay, you can be as God. That's the same thing he believed in himself, as we read from Isaiah, exalted himself above God, didn't he? And so that's what he's always doing, even today. The things that we've been given spiritual weapons of warfare, that we can tear down those strongholds that exalt themselves above the knowledge of God, right? That's what we're told in, is it 1 Corinthians what? 10, somewhere in there, we're told that we're given spiritual weapons of warfare to be able to tear down those strongholds that exalt themselves above the knowledge of God. So it's always those things that come from the enemy where there's an exalting of something above God, himself, us, okay? That self-deification of man and the removal of God as a person. That was the delusion that was the Gnostic heresy, wasn't it? God didn't come in the flesh. And you, yourself, are divine. Is that a lie that's being propagated today? Yeah. We hear that in the church today. All you have to do to really come to that place of healing is understand your own divinity within you. And once you find that, then you'll be healed of your emotional disorders and all these. Now, it's really interesting because all those people that are finding divinity within, okay? What's happening to tons and tons of those people? You know what they're doing? They're killing themselves. Now, isn't it wild? Because during this time, men who are being deluded with those things, they're going to come to the point where they want to destroy themselves and they can't. That's wild, isn't it? Now people get away with it. They blow their head off or whatever. Once that, you know, and that's what Satan comes to do. He comes to destroy, right? And so ultimately wants to destroy people. So he uses demonic doctrines to delude people to where they become mentally unstable. They become disillusioned and filled with anxieties and depressions and every other form of thing that he tries to get people to do from his doctrines. And then they destroy themselves ultimately. They're either destroyed mentally or they're destroyed mentally and physically. And Satan wants to do that. There, the men can't do that. Now, going back to some of the garb of these locusts, we see all this stuff. I just encourage you to play around with looking at those things that the garb of these locusts wear. And I believe it's, again, relates to this false appearance from these false prophets and these false Christs. Okay? I think the locusts, the physical locusts that maybe come on the earth have some look like that. But I think it also depicts, they have a golden crown. Okay? They're masquerading as deity. Okay? But they have faces like men. Okay? So they're teaching humanitarian or humanistic doctrines. Self-deification. Okay? There's other aspects. They have long hair like a woman. There's a Old Testament passage, I can't think where it's at right now, where the king is entangled in the tresses of the woman's locks. In other words, he's seduced and deceived by her. So there's seducing spirits that bring about these seducing doctrines, where the people are overwhelmed and the world ultimately begins to worship Satan. Okay. Now this is long after, at this point, it's after the ecclesia, the false ecclesia, has already been cast down and destroyed, hasn't it? So now it moves into full-on self-worship that moves on into total Satan worship, ultimately. He gets what he wants. He gets people deceived to the point where he's able to present himself as God to them, and they worship him. So that's the picture that we're seeing today. Now, I want to go back for a minute to talk about one of the delusions that we need to be aware of today. Now, we just talked about the delusions of self-deification or finding the divine within. That's a major, major thing that's going on. But something that we need to be very aware of, which is of the Antichrist spirit that's going on in the church today, and I already mentioned it, is Israel being the church and the church being Israel. Okay? And Marlene showed me these films this week that I looked at, and it was just, again, a good refresher, and it just made me realize some things that are going to take place. When we talk about the mystery of Babylon, okay, and what's that's going to be, it's going to be a Judeo-Christian religious system that is going to be a false system representing the church in Israel coming into the tribulation. Because we know both Israel makes a covenant with him, but the false church is going to be making a covenant with the Antichrist also. Okay? They're in fact going to be able to control him for a while, or seemingly control him, because the woman does what? We're going to find out the woman at first, which is Mystery Babylon, the false ecclesia, the church, is directing the beast. He's the woman riding on the beast's back. Directing. So the church makes a covenant with hell as well as Israel. And I believe it's the church as it believes it is Israel. And that's really a lot to say, and there's a lot of people that would probably like to cut my tongue out for saying that, but that's what I believe one of the delusions of this day is right now, is we're being bombarded with replacement theology throughout the evangelical church today. And it was very interesting watching this film, because one of the films I didn't watch, both watched the one, and the young man who represented Palestinian Christian, the Palestinian Christians, very, very well spoken, knew the scriptures very well, and spoke eloquently when he spoke the scriptures. And you go, wow, that makes a good point. I got to think about that. The Jewish Christian who was on the side of obviously dispensationalism and non-replacement theology and the idea of what we're teaching here spoke very well too, and kind of put the guy's points at rest. But what just really hit me was the fact that this Palestinian Christian is not opposed to Israel, as Israel would become the church and the church would become Israel. But he's absolutely opposed to Israel as they're in the land today, because Israel in the land is opposed to them, and they are to some extent. Okay? And so that's where the battle goes on. But he has no problem, and his desire is to see Israel be saved, so that we all, the Israel of God, as he would say, can all go on into taking possession of all the covenant promises that God promised to us. And that includes what? The land. And he sees the land as not just the land of Israel, but the whole earth. Isn't that interesting? Does that fit and play right into what we're just talking about today? Okay. It's the spirit of Antichrist at work in the church today, opening people's hearts up to a strong delusion. Okay. And so these people, the church and it, church as it claims to be Israel, combined with many deceived Jews, who I believe will see eye to eye with that group in that day. I don't know how it's going to happen, but somehow it's all going to happen. They're going to see eye to eye at that point, and they're going to go into the tribulation as this false Christendom, okay? And that's part of the delusion that's going on. So today, then, we need to, because these things are, we see the foreshadows of all these things. Remember, again, they're in chapter 18. My people come out of her, okay? Don't be deluded by these delusions of Satan. Satan has limited power now, but the same deceptions are being played out on the earth right now that are going to come into full force in the tribulation. So we've got to be careful of those things today. We've got to look at those things and understand what they are. We're called to test the spirits. We can't just jump in and go along with everything that everybody's talking about. I mean, I would encourage you, could you send people the links to that? If anybody's interested, talk to Marlene, and she can send you the link to those films. And I think it would be worth you watching. And you may come away going, I don't totally understand. And we can clarify some of that stuff more for you. But I think it would be very intriguing for you to watch some of that stuff and see what some of that. I thought there were. Okay, I saw another one after that by the guy that was the Jewish Christian. And I didn't get to watch. I thought it was in the same link. Maybe it was just something that came up on YouTube.
Christ at the Checkpoint. I'm sorry. Christ at the
Checkpoint. Yeah. Yeah, and Christ at the Checkpoint is, it's a movement of Palestinian Christians. And they, by the way, are very anti-Semitic. They're not anti-Jewish in the sense that Jews can get saved into the church and we all can become spiritual Israel or the Israel of God. But they're anti-Jew in Jerusalem and in the land today. And they're totally anti the, they really don't like the evangelical Zionist mentality, which I don't like all of it either, by the way. There's another side to it too, but we won't get into that. Anyway, it's important for us to understand those things today because you may, in fact, be confronted with that in your Christian walk. You may be confronted with Christians. They're going to want to talk about the idea of how we're all going to inherit the kingdom soon, and we all need to just begin to work for those kingdom promises that God has given to his people. Okay? That all sounds really good, doesn't it? Working for the kingdom promises and the fulfillment of all that God wants for the church and all that he's designed for his people, the people of God. That sounds good to me. Okay? When you listen to this guy, you'll go, that sounds good. When I was listening to the first speaker, I was like, that sounds good, knowing what I was looking at, but it was, sounds good. Yeah, Marcy?
I may be totally botched up what you just said, but are you saying that the Jewish, the Christian Palestinians think that they and the Jews will not go through tribulation?
Well, what they really believe, yeah, I mean, that would be part of it, but what they believe is that the church has replaced Israel. And that's not a new theology, by the way. That's an age-old theology that comes from way back. It's just become very prominent once again, and it really fits the mentality of the Palestinian Christian in Palestine because the Palestinian people are in constant conflict with the Jews that are in the land, and so it fits that. It's a wonderful theology for them because, on one hand, they can say we're really reaching out to the Jew so that we can see them saved into the fullness of their promises. But these ones that are persecuting and coming against us are totally anti-God and everything else. So it fits their theology. Yeah, Marlene?
It's just kind of interesting. Today, some of you remember my friend Diane Mann. Well, she just went to Israel and came back. And she made this comment to me, which it'll fit when I tell you. She said they visited the West Bank, and their tour guide was a Palestinian Christian. And she said, they came to a, I guess it's a church, the group that she went with, the church supports something in the West Bank. Anyway, she said they went to visit that site, and there was a conversation. The Palestinian Christian was talking to the woman of this organization, and she said they couldn't understand everything because they were talking in Hebrew, but she said he was so kind and gentle and just asking questions, and the Jewish woman was so stiff-necked and short, and I thought, isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
I said, don't go by what you see.
Yeah, exactly.
Because that's how it's going to be.
Well, and here's another flip side. A group from Calvary Chapel Corvallis just got back from Israel. And while they were there, they had a Jewish guide who's the guide for their tour. And the Jewish guide, when they were in a certain place, made a comment about the Palestinians. Well, there was a girl and her grandfather, right? Yeah, that were on the tour, who are Christians living in the United States, but he grew up in the land of Palestine and was greatly offended by the whole thing and began to really question this whole issue of, does Israel even have a right to be in the land today? You know, and he went back to, brought him right back to his childhood of losing their land and stuff when all the conflicts were happening and stuff. And he was really, you know, kind of upset about the whole thing. And the girl is in my son's house church. And so she was talking to Jens about how does that all fit? And he was trying to explain it prophetically and those kinds of things. But so there's those two sides, and you see why there's the conflict going on. Because this Jew made an offensive comment. I mean, it was the wrong thing to do, and it put off this man who's obviously a lover of Jesus, you know, who's a Christian, and it kind of set him off the other way. So it's interesting, two sides. And so those are the things that the enemy is using to try and confuse people into this whole idea where we've all got to just come together as one and finally recognize that we're all under one God, and then he has these great and precious promises for all of us. Okay, and that'll include other religions too, the world, ultimately. But so, you know, we've got to be wise to that whole delusion that's going on right now, because that's what we're being taught in the church today, is that the ecclesia, the church, needs to come together as one. And we need to embrace everybody. And that's embrace non-Christians as though they're like Christians, and embrace every other religion of the world, and embrace the Jews, and embrace all these different groups. And, you know, and embrace them by setting aside anything that would cause conflict and confusion. That ultimately means setting aside the gospel of Jesus Christ. So there's the foundation of our whole faith. It's gone.
I just have a question. Yeah. Was the Jew in that situation a believer in the Messiah, or just...
No. Okay. No, he was just... I don't know if secular or was... Did they say if he was a practicing Jew or just a secular?
Well, he wasn't a Messianic.
Yeah, no, wasn't a Messianic. He wasn't a Christian by any means. But he, no, I think maybe had some Orthodox beliefs, but just made, it was just an offhanded comment, but it was, you know, obviously it offended this guy.
What's interesting is, because I have friends that are Messianic, well, they are Jewish.
Yeah.
Raised Jewish, but they do believe Jesus is the Messiah. And if you go into that one subject of replacement theology, it's like something unleashes inside, and they just are very vehement about their conviction of being God's chosen people. So I could just imagine in that scenario, if you added Jews that were believers in the Messiah alongside Palestinian Christians, how, wow, that would be...
Yeah, it could be it'd be very much of it. And that's what's going on, is there is a conflict, you know, going on even within the church. And so, you know, we've got to be wise to these different doctrines that are really demonic doctrines that are floating around out there that really delude people. And what they're going to do is delude people into ultimately entering into the tribulation as the ecclesia, the church.
It isn't just church, because my friend Leanne and her husband is not a believer, and they visited about a month ago, and he made a comment like, I can't remember exactly, but it was like, well, the Palestinians were there in the land first, and have a right. I mean, he has swallowed that whole.
Yeah.
I mean, it has nothing to do with the church. He's getting it through the secular.
Right. And you know, and that's the thing. That's the thing that we've got to be wise to too. God's obviously doing a work with the Jews, but we know that the major regathering of them is going to be under that covenant. So we've got to be careful as evangelicals, because there's evangelical Zionism. Okay, and we all probably fit into that camp because we have a dispensational viewpoint of the scriptures, like we're teaching now. So we tend to fit into that camp of being those who say, yeah, part of scripture is being fulfilled because Israel's in the land, part of their promises are coming back. But I think we need to be careful with that too. I don't go to the other side that say they have no right, because they obviously do have a right scripturally and everything else. But when they're really going to be drawn into the land is under that covenant. When that covenant's made, then they're going to come into the land. So what's going on now that's happened since 1948, whether that's the Valley of the Dry Bones, part of that that's come to pass or not, I'm very careful not to jump into that, because all of those scriptures are tribulational. They're Daniel's 70th weekish. When you look at them, it says, in that day, in that day, in that day. None of them say sometime before that day. So I'm very careful not to jump into that, but I'm not going to argue that the Jews shouldn't be there right now, and I'm not going to get caught up on the other side either and say that it belongs to the Palestinians. According to God, that land belongs to the Jews. They will ultimately inhabit that land, and they will have that as their permanent possession. Okay, they will have that. But I'm not going to get in an argument over whether it's now or not. I think, well, I'll just give you my own personal take. I still believe that they're in the land today. I can't say it's not by God's hand. He did things, obviously. But I know the real fulfillment of it doesn't happen until the 70th week begins. That's when it really, really starts being fulfilled, that they come into the land, and they come into the land by that peace covenant. So it does say that, you know, there's some in the land before that. It gives you that indication too. But I just think that's when the fullness of it happens. So we've got to be careful, I think, just not to get caught up in that argument and keep an open heart to all people, both Jews, because we're told that we can still provoke the Jews to jealousy, right? And that's how we preach the gospel to the Jews. We provoke them with jealousy, saying, hey, we got the Spirit and you don't. No, it's not quite like that. But, I mean, that's sort of what Paul said there, didn't he? He's like, he says, you know, we provoke them with jealousy by showing that, wow, we have Christ now. And we have the Spirit of God dwelling in us, which was one of their promises. Okay? So we can do that. But and at the same time, we preach the gospel to the Palestinian Arabs and the Arabs all over the Middle East and everything else too. So, yeah, Annie?
What you said is so important to understand, that in the evangelical circuit, replacement theology is very, very popular and rising.
Yeah.
And what that does is it fosters a certain superiority from a Christian's perspective to a Jewish person.
Yeah.
And it's hard to know how to navigate when you're in a situation with people that have a desire to share the gospel with the Jewish nation or the
yeah.
Jewish people.
Yeah.
And there's this, I mean, it's in my own family. I have family. My family's background is Jewish converts to Catholicism.
Yeah.
So you can't have a conversation with people my age and my family that live in South America about our Jewish family, because they believe that they have replaced the Jews
right.
By converting to Catholicism. And
yeah.
It is such a deep wound.
Yeah, well, and it's...
It's so much a volatile emotion. It's shocking.
Well, and it's produced... It is what's produced anti-Semitism throughout the world since the beginning of that time that those doctrines came into the church. That's, you know, the Catholic Church slaughtered more Jews than anything else.
Yes.
You know, so, I mean, that's it's created great anti-Semitism. It's doing it again,
I mean, even in the Mennonite church, I had a conversation with the bishop when I first came to Alturas to go to South America, and I asked him that question, does your church teach in replacement theology? And he said, well, lots of us do, but I personally do not. Which I thought was really kind of him to say the truth of how he felt. You know?
Yeah.
But I guess even in that conservative church, of which wouldn't be considered evangelical so much as it would be Anabaptist, there's that sense of superiority.
Yeah.
You know, we have the truth. We have the Messiah. You chose not to want him.
Yeah.
We inherit all the promises. We inherit the land. We inherit everything.
Yeah, and it creates, it creates that kind of friction.
I think what I was trying to get to ask you was, when you're talking with someone like that who has that wall up, and I guess just through prayer perhaps, to share with them that by having that conviction that they have that superiority over God's chosen people, they really make themselves vulnerable to the Antichrist.
Well, yeah, and you know, I think one of the best things to do is, because honestly, it's a spiritual deception. So it's a delusion from Satan. So he's blinded people's minds. They might be Christians. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying they're not Christian people. But we know that Satan can blind the minds of the Christians even. You know, like it says there, where is it, where he says that they've been taken snare to do the enemy's will. That's in 1 Corinthians, isn't it? Yeah, taking them captive to do his will. And so he's talking about Christians that were taken captive to do the enemy's will. So we know they're Christians. And so first thing we need to do is pray that their eyes would be enlightened, because what's happened, they've fallen under darkness. So, you know, we need to pray that God really gives them light and they can begin to see the light of the scriptures again. And then encourage them to go to the scriptures. You know, Romans 9, 10, 11, the whole discourse, specifically Romans 11, and really look at that discourse there, what Paul's saying. Paul's dealing with that issue of God is not through with Israel yet. How about this? Because we could discuss this all afternoon. Let's carry this on for our midweek discussion. And what we'll do is I'll put together the scriptures that the replacement theologian would use to prove his point that we have replaced Israel. Okay, and then we'll go, you know, not as big a debate as those two guys had, but we'll go to the other side and look at that. We'll do that for our Wednesday night Bible study and kind of look at that. And I'll say this, spend some time reading this week. Read Ephesians 2 and 3. Well, just read Ephesians 1 through 3. And then read Galatians 2 and 3. And read Romans 9, 10, and 11. And then we'll use those and we'll look at those. And I'll guarantee you that by reading them without really digging in, discerning, you'll get confused until you get to Romans 11, okay? There'll be certain aspects of it you'll go, well, I don't know. Maybe they've got a good point. But when you take it all in its context, which context always rules, then you'll start to see that the replacement theologian is an error in expounding upon those scriptures he uses, and he won't deal with Romans 11 either. So anyway, and maybe, you know, watch that film if you get that link. That'll really give you good insight into that. But even after I watched that film, I had to go back to those scriptures and look at them for myself and go, okay, well, I want to make sure that, you know, I'm not in error somewhere here too. So anyway, we better close here. We're way long. Let's pray.